By request of a meeting participant, the meeting is being recorded. Recording started.
So Lucia and I are going to talk about a project that we're working on from different, we're working on collaboratively about healthy food systems. And so we were going to divide this up, but I was going to talk about kind of what PRE is contributing, which is to really, kind of look at the science linking reproductive health to the food system. And then Lucia's going to talk about all the actual real world work that people are doing to change the system. So I just wanted to acknowledge, in addition to Lucia and myself, David Willinga with the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy is a partner on the white paper that we're writing, and at PRE, Tracy and Joe Perrone, and also Healthcare Without Harm, Michelle Gottlieb are all participants, and also to acknowledge that Planned Parenthood had provided funding to PRE to support the development of the white paper. So when you look at your dinner plate, the idea of this project essentially is to realize that whatever shows up in front of us, it doesn't just come from anywhere. There's, in fact, a very complex food system that is indeed global that's going to inform what we see. And this project really does mean to try to intervene upstream at the system. So as you all know, there's a lot of influences from the environment on reproductive health. And one of the reasons that we wanted to look at healthy food systems is because, you know, typically we might be looking at environmental chemicals or nutrition or the built environment. But the food system, when you look at it as a system, you really get to bring all of these things together and have much more of an ecological framework. And actually, I would say that even, I didn't circle genetics, but the truth is that since environmental chemicals have a real influence on how our genes can be expressed through epigenetic mechanisms, you could really even circle genetics in this. So by looking at it as a system-wide effort, we're hoping to actually bring a lot of things that influence reproductive health together. So why does food matter? I think everyone on this call is kind of would recognize all of these ideas. It's basically not just the health of individuals, but in fact we depend on the environment to grow the food that we need for sustenance. So the idea of looking at human health and environmental health as one package, they're completely integrated. And we need to kind of consider all of those effects when we think about the food we eat. Our current food system is very energy intensive. The food that we get out of it is marginally nutritious. There's a lot of public health and ecological health harm. And also, as you all know, as many of you as providers, that obesity, diabetes, malnutrition, childhood cancer, there's many other chronic disease impacts that are directly attributable to our industrialized food system. So what our project is really about is looking at vulnerable populations. And so food matters to everybody, but food matters especially to pregnant women, children, and future generations for several reasons. One is that nutrition matters very much. Obviously, good nutrition is an essential requirement of healthy human development. And vulnerability matters. So as you all on this call know, developing fetuses and humans are not just little adults. They eat more, drink more, and breathe more on a per unit body weight basis than adults. They have different, children have different environmental behaviors. Their systems, when humans are born, their systems are not really, their immune systems and their neurological systems are not really at full capacity in terms of dealing with environmental insults. And also timing matters. So the health consequences of the in utero and early life exposures, as we know now, can manifest across a lifespan. So for all of these reasons, we're really focusing on the vulnerabilities, and the effort is to really change food systems to improve children's health and therefore future generations' health. And I'm going to just go into the details a little bit about the issue of timing matters. As you all know, there are critical and sensitive windows of development. So when you have environmental exposures during certain times, the consequences can be much more profound. And also, the consequences can be both immediate but very much long-term. And a lot of relevance in terms of the food work is that these issues about how developmental origins of adult disease, they the science that informs this work came both from the field of nutrition and the field of environmental health. And the science was developed independently in both of these fields, and it's interesting in terms of working on the food system work because you can see this complete nexus of these very different traditions coming together. So it's probably quite relevant in terms of the food system work to understand the work about developmental origins of adult disease that came out of the field of nutrition. And that work came in the mid-80s. It began when epidemiology, some studies that came out of England and Wales found that poor nutrition in early life appeared to increase the susceptibility of an affluent diet. In this case, people who had low birth weight when they were born, but they were then exposed to a quote-unquote affluent diet, seemed to be, they did have a much higher risk of ischemic heart disease. So that body of research led to this hypothesis that was generated in the 90s about developmental origins of adult disease. And the idea is essentially that there's imprinting that happens in utero. And in the field of nutrition, there's a huge body of work now that substantiates this hypothesis. And I'm just going to talk about one study, which is rather illustrative, which came from, this is from 2005. There was a famine during World War II in Holland, and there were very good data available to look at in terms of what nutrition was before the famine and after the famine and during the famine. And what the study found, that maternal undernutrition during gestation had a very important health effect later in life, and indeed that the timing of the nutritional insult determined which organ system was affected. So if you look at this slide, you can see up here that they were able to, in fact, separate when, in this case, the environmental exposure is to the Dutch famine, when it occurred, either late, mid, or early in gestation. And they were able to then track people from this birth cohort and found that if you were exposed to the famine in early gestation, you had this increase in coronary heart disease and more obesity. Exposure in mid-gestation led to increases in obstructive airway disease, and in late gestation, you had impaired glucose tolerance. In the fields of environmental health, the DES is, in fact, the most robust example of essentially the same thing in our field. And I know you're all familiar with DES, and essentially, the issue of DES has been not just confirmed in human data, but there's a very robust body of animal data which substantiates this issue of timing of exposure and late effects. I also just wanted to mention, since we're talking about food, though, that the same kind of data exists in the environmental health field related to, let's say, pesticides, for example. So in animal studies, you can see if you So first of all, in terms of the pesticide chlorpyrifos, the usual health outcome that we are concerned about is cholinesterase inhibition. So when you look at animal data at environmentally relevant levels of chlorpyrifos, so long before you see that health effect, which is kind of considered the health effect of chlorpyrifos, that you see these subtle neurological effects. And when you expose the animals, not only affects what the mechanism is of harm, but in fact the outcome changes. So you have this moving target depending on when you're exposing the animals, and the effects are in fact widespread and you know, quite important effects in terms of the health of the animals. So the bottom line is that we have a wealth of human and animal data to support these concerns, both in the field of nutrition and in environmental health. So then I was just going to briefly review the white paper that we have goes through many, many different parts of the food system, and I was just going to pick out some of the key concerns of the industrialized food system that we cover and give you a couple of examples. One is the issue of widespread exposure to toxic chemicals, antibiotic resistance, foodborne illness, environmental destruction, and high levels of consumption of foods of marginal nutritional value. So in terms of widespread exposure to chemicals with reproductive and developmental toxicity, hold on, I'm just going to take a drink of water. So these data were analyzed by my colleagues here at CREE. It's a it's a subset of an NHANES data. In this case, it's NHANES data that is of just of U.S. pregnant women. And what it shows, so this is population prevalence data, and it shows, in fact, that pregnant women in the U.S. are exposed to all of these chemicals at the same time. And the exposures do not just come from the food system, but the food system is a very big driver of many of these exposures, and I'm going to just point out a few. So if you look at If you look at, let's say, bisphenol A, which we were talking about earlier from canned goods, is a big contributor, obviously, in the linings of cans. Pesticides, so we have the organophosphate pesticides, but also the organochlorine pesticides like DDT. Look at the levels here. They're completely ubiquitous in pregnant women, and these pesticides, many of them were phased out many years ago. Then in terms of the perfluorinated compounds, we have these kind of, these exposures come from, these chemicals are used to line food packaging that you want to be grease resistant, and also is used as a precursor to make Teflon. So the food system is contributing through packaging and the things we even cook in. And then there's a whole bunch of chemicals that are, that enter the food system having nothing to do with the food system, like PCBs and heavy metals, mercury, et cetera, that have to do with things that happen outside the food system, like coal-fired power plants, that then put mercury into the environment and then, of course, get through biotransformation into our fish. So the point is that looking at the whole system, there's many things that are contributing chemicals of really important reproductive and developmental toxicity. So finding solutions, we need to kind of step back and see how these things are getting into the environment and address it as one whole package. No pun intended. Anyway, the other point I just wanted to make in terms of these exposures is that the cumulative exposures do add up. So this is just for pesticides, but the point is that food is just one source of pesticides for kids, and they're getting many others. And so, and in fact, if you add them up, many children in the U.S. have levels of pesticide exposure that are of concern in terms of neurological impacts. So briefly, I'll just run through the others. Antibiotic resistance, these on the picture here is of a factory farm for pigs, and basically these conditions require that animals are given non-therapeutically given antibiotics. And, of course, there's a great concern that this is contributing to antibiotic resistance in the use of antibiotics for medical purposes. Foodborne illness is a huge issue, and some of the features of our food system that contribute to foodborne illness are that we have these highly centralized and large distribution channels that make the detection of contaminated foods easier, but it greatly expands the reach and the magnitude of one food, you know, of a breach in food safety. So, for example, there was just one plant in Georgia that had contamination of salmonella, and that caused illness in 529 individuals in 43 states. And it's not just that it was like, well, these jars of peanut butter got out far. It's that the original salmonella-contaminated peanut butter was put in just an amazing amount of different products. So this, the whole integration of the food system makes it actually quite difficult to even track the final uses of all these products. Another concern in terms of foodborne illness is just that the high-speed automated processing of slaughtering makes contamination more likely and also more difficult to detect, and obviously there's huge occupational exposure concerns not related to food in these slaughtering plants. In terms of environmental destruction, our food system is very energy inefficient. It contributes to a lot of pollution through pesticides and nitrogen fertilizer runoff. You need fossil fuels to run the machinery. All our chemical fertilizers are natural gas derived. Pesticides are obviously petroleum derived chemicals. And then the transportation, I would just say of note, at least for myself, it was a new thought to realize that although transportation is important relative to livestock production, it's a relatively small contributor, which doesn't mean you shouldn't buy local food, but it's just another thing to consider in terms of thinking about the relative weight of these contributors. In terms of environmental destruction, livestock production is a huge contributor to global warming. It's more than transportation, slightly less than energy production. And also, the livestock contribution to climate change has to do with the fact that we're using fossil fuel-intensive grain, not so much that it's just raising animals, but it's because of the grain we're feeding these animals that's producing this huge contribution. And finally, in terms of high level of consumption of foods of low nutritional value, as you all know, obesity is a huge problem. High fructose corn syrup has increased tremendously over the last 30 years. And our food supply doesn't look like this for no reason. I mean, basically, there's huge marketing that's aimed at essentially informing all our choices and the choices people make for their children. And so, with that, now that I've kind of outlined some of the health concerns that we have, I was going to turn to Lucia to tell you all the great things that people are doing to basically make this apparent and visible to healthcare providers and change the food system.
Great. Thanks, Pat.
I have to stop sharing.
There we go. Now I start screen sharing. Thanks, everyone, for your patience here for a minute. There. Can everyone see that? The big colorful slide?
Oh, my goodness. I actually unfortunately stopped sharing, and I seem to go away, so I'll have to get back online. Oh, no, meeting place.
Else? Can everyone see that slide with the blackberries and carrots?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Great. Great. So first of all, my name's Lucia Serra. I know some of you on the phone, but not everyone. I'm the co-director of the San Francisco Bay Area chapter of PSR, Physicians for Social Responsibility. And I'm going to transition now, as Pat said, into more of sort of what are we going to do to get this information into the hands of clinicians who are talking to their patients and patients' families and working in healthcare facilities. But I wanted to give everyone a bit of a sort of overview of where this project fits into larger work on healthier foods in hospitals. So for those of you who are not familiar with Healthcare Without Harm, it is a coalition of about 470 organizations working to improve the environmental health of the healthcare sector. And SFPSR, we've been a member of the coalition for about the past 10 years and work closely with Healthcare Without Harm, particularly in the areas of prevention of exposure to environmental toxicants, climate change, and food. And with Healthcare Without Harm, SFPSR has been collaborating for about the past 6 years on a healthier foods in healthcare campaign as part of our environmental health work. We're basically responsible for the Healthy Foods in Hospitals campaign here in California, and Healthcare Without Harm has about 12 other regional organizers around the country in other organizations who are helping to move this food work forward all over the country. So the Food Matters, the clinical education and advocacy program, is basically an expansion of an ongoing 6-year effort to engage the healthcare sector in helping to promote and support a healthier food system. And the Food Matters piece is specifically with the goal to educate and really get clinicians engaged in the work. And when I use the word clinicians, it is a very broad definition. We're talking about physicians and nurses and nurse practitioners and midwives and promotoras and really any maternal and child health providers. Getting them more engaged in the work. So basically just wanted to sort of outline how this work got started and why there was this focus on how the healthcare community might be able to help build a healthier food system. And it's kind of broken down into 3 parts. And the first one, well, first of all, the decisions that all of us make about what to eat and where our food comes from, our personal choices can definitely help influence the health of our food system, but it's in there can be a whole lot more impact if you think about moving an entire sector towards making that shift, and particularly the healthcare sector. So we're working to make food service in hospitals part of the overall healing mission by modeling good dietary patterns within their hospital food service that help prevent disease. And the second one is moving the marketplace. I mean, food is big business in the healthcare sector to the tune of about $14 billion a year. So we're working with hospitals to purchase more food products from farms that are ecologically sound as well as socially responsible, working with the healthcare sector to really try to set a standard for other institutions to follow, including a lot of sustainability criteria in their purchasing contracts when they go to negotiate with their group purchasing organizations, and really trying to help move the marketplace towards more access to healthier foods for all of us. And the third area is the is maximizing the clinical voice, and this is really where the Food Matters program fits in, and it's an area that we have been doing some work on, but we're really interested in amping it up a bit. So it's about encouraging.
Now departing.
Sandy.
Okay, so it's about encouraging clinicians to provide anticipatory guidance messaging for their patients and families about the importance of healthy foods. And I just want to give you a brief overview about what's kind of been happening over these 6 years of this Healthier Foods in Hospitals campaign. Over 300 hospitals now have signed what's called the Healthy Foods in Hospitals Pledge, which is a pledge that the Healthcare Without Harm campaign developed with all of the regional organizers on a national food work group. It's basically a qualitative commitment to taking a look at your hospital food service and assessing where you could be purchasing more local foods, more organic foods if possible, and just healthier foods in general. About 40 hospitals just over the past 2 years have committed to reducing the amount of meat protein on their menus, and that picture to the right is the balance. It's called the Balanced Menus Challenge, which was actually developed here at SFPSR and is now a national program with Healthcare Without Harm. And it's for both as a climate change mitigation strategy, but also as a public health concern. And then the rest of the list, hospitals are buying more local, seasonal, and organic foods, buying hormone and antibiotic-free foods, and that's primarily in dairy products and meat products, growing more food in hospital gardens, and also hosting farmers markets on site. Many of you may be familiar with Kaiser Permanente's efforts around farmers markets. I think they have upwards of 35 or more markets now located on sites at hospitals and health centers. And then work on preventing waste in food services and also composting programs. And these kinds of programs are happening in hospitals all around the country. On the policy front, just wanted to give you an example. This list of health professional organizations and healthcare institutions have all adopted healthy food systems related policy statements over the past few years. So there's work being done also at the policy level, and you can see the variety of people that and organizations that are very interested in this work. So back to the Food Matters, in terms of the healthcare education and advocacy program, we are really, really going to focus on sort of translating and conveying that information that Patrice just laid out, the science behind Food Matters, but also really trying to inspire clinicians to become more advocates for these issues. And we have it in kind of three different categories. And the first one is in their communications with their patients and families about the importance of healthy foods. And the second one is working within their healthcare facilities and hospitals to create healthier food service and really pushing their administrations to do so. We work a lot with food service personnel around the country in hospitals and have heard over and over again how helpful it would be to them to have the clinicians really backing them up. I mean, food service is sort of right up there with janitorial supplies in terms of the budget and people's concern and thinking about it. And to get the clinical voice behind that as, you know, we really do need to do this in our facility, it's a good idea, it's a good model, would help move the work along a lot. And the third level is at the policy, sort of working within the community, the local, regional, and a national level to promote policies that support the development of healthy, accessible, and fair food system. And finally, I just want to kind of go over what some of the different components that we're going to be developing here in the next 6 months to a year, the different components of the Food Matters program. First of all, we've established a clinical advisory group to basically oversee all of this work as we roll it out. And we have clinicians from a variety of different specialties, and we have nurses involved, public health specialists, and people from all over the country from various facilities, sort of helping us to oversee the work. And then we are going to take the white paper that Patrice was talking about and use it to develop a curriculum, a clinical curriculum, to offer trainings to clinicians around the country. We have received some initial grant funding to offer some pilot trainings around the country, and we're starting in Oakland, Philadelphia, Boston, and Vermont. And the same, the regional organizers who are working on the Healthcare Without Harm campaign are going to be coordinating these pilots in the various cities. And just speaking for Oakland and the work we're doing here, we have developed a great relationship with Children's Hospital of Oakland, and they are going to be helping. They're going to host the training, and they're also going to be helping with outreach to get a really wide variety of clinicians to the training, including people who work in their community outreach, their clinics, their obesity programs, really a wide spectrum of clinicians. And we actually even have a date for the Oakland training beginning of March 2011. So, and then the Nationwide Clinical Network is
now attending.
Kimberly McGuire.
The Nationwide Clinical Network is to have something sort of in place so that once these clinicians go through this training, and we're talking generally about like a half-day CME-accredited training, once they've gone through that training, that there is a network that we can immediately plug people into who want to become active in the kind of policy arena. You know, we know here at PSR that if we do these clinical, you know, anytime we do a clinical presentation or an educational program, if we don't plug people in right away or, you know, get in touch with them right away and kind of figure out a way to get them active, we tend to lose folks just because everyone's so busy and they get on to other stuff. So we're trying to get this network established before we actually get these trainings going. And we're working with David Wellinga at IATP. They're developing something called the Healthy Food Action Network, which is very similar to what we're talking about here. So we're going to be working with IATP to get that developed. And then the maternal child health calendar, on to the right, there's an example of what 1 month might look like. It's still in the development phase, but we're going to be developing a calendar that
now departing
Charlotte Brody
that maternal and child health providers can give out at clinic visits and hand out to their patients and their patients' families with just information and advice about eating healthier foods and preparing healthier foods, that kind of thing. And we're working on a video that would be available for distribution, and people could use it in waiting rooms or clinics, exam rooms, even at community meetings. We're hoping to do that both in English and Spanish. And that would, so both the calendar and the video are things that the clinicians would receive at the training as sort of take-homes and giveaways for their patients. and their patients' families. And then just continued work on this Healthy Foods in Hospitals campaign and really getting the clinicians involved in that work, connecting the clinicians up with the food service directors that we already work with to see how they can support their efforts and that kind of thing. So that's the Food Matters clinical program.
The calendar looks great, Lucia.
Yeah,
the program is really great.
Well, the calendar is actually, I have this fantasy of, you know, those take-home baskets that new moms receive with a bunch of, you know, diapers and formula products and sort of these little plasticky giveaways. We envision a whole different basket with this health, you know, with this calendar and with some farmers market bucks in particular communities that have those and, you know, some organic fruits and vegetables and really kind of sending people home from the hospital with a much more positive message. So that's sort
great.
Of in the dream works. So.
Wow.
And that's it.
Thank you. Thank you, both of you. That's really fantastic. So
yeah,
this
you're
is
welcome.
This is kind of started, and you said you're going to be doing the training in Oakland in March.
Yeah, we have a date on the calendar already with Children's Hospital, which is great, of March 5th in Oakland, and then other regional organizers in Philly, Boston, and Vermont are working on setting up training dates there. But I have to say, we have had overwhelming response. I mean, we were at the AAP meeting about a month ago here in San Francisco and just talking up the project and telling people about it. And we've done, you know, phone presentations for a group of docs in Detroit who are really interested in bringing it to their facilities. So, you know, there's nothing to stop us from developing those relationships now and sort of getting that work underway as we hold these pilots next spring.
That's fantastic.
Now attending.
Kay.
Yeah.
Well, we're just, I heard Kimberly and Kay just came on. We're just wrapping up, though.
Oh, no. Oh, was it Eastern? I thought it was Eastern State. 1 to 2?
No, 12 to 1.
Oh, my gosh. I have an email that says 1 to 2.
There was an error, actually. That was my fault. I sent out an email with the wrong time and then sent an email afterwards saying that was the wrong time, so I apologize for that.
Oh, well, I didn't get the other. Oh, well, I'll hear the wrap-up.
yes, for sure. We'll send notes. And we just heard from Patrice and Lucia. They presented their paper on Food Matters, which was really great, but it was recorded so we can...
I'll
listen to it, and I don't know if you're able to share slides at all, but I'm sure some people would be interested in doing that. Or else, maybe when we do the web conference, we're hoping to get you guys to do our web conference, and we can invite others to that as well.
We also have a brochure on the Food Matters Clinical Education Advocacy Program. We have a brochure in PDF that
I'm happy
to send around to people if they'd like to see that.
That would be fantastic.
Kind of outlines what we've just talked about.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we're a little bit over our time, but thank you, everybody. And
now departing.
Nancy.
As we talked about last time, we're not going to have a meeting in December with all the holidays because we're kind of looking at doing it every other month. So we'll talk again in January.
Now departing.
Bob Gould, San Francisco.
And we'll send out numbers and meeting requests and everything.
Great.
Thank you
for the opportunity.
Oh, nice. Thank you so much. This is great.
Well, And Ellie, you said that we'd be able to pick up on the discussion today on the webinar?
Well, we're going to have another webinar for the Green Choices Project.
Mm-hmm.
And we're talking to Patrice maybe about doing this presentation.
Good.
Okay. We're still talking.
We'd be I'm sure.
Sandy and Patrice have talked.
we'd be delighted to do that, I'm sure. And, you know, and we did a, you know, a because there's obviously, it was like somewhat, truncated, you know what I'm trying to say, so we can do what